Next, we turn to end-of-life issues, as we do on a quarterly basis. Kim Mooney of Practically Dying joining me in the studio. Good morning, Kim.
Good morning, Matt.
Today we're going to talk about how we die and the complexity of physician-assisted or physician aid in dying. This is a topic that has been in the news, excuse me, a lot because of efforts at various different state legislatures, including our own here in Colorado. And we're going to talk about some of the nuance in this, the complexities. But we have two very qualified guests to talk about this. Kim, I'll let you introduce them this morning.
Thank you. I have had the pleasure of knowing both of these women for a long time. Jean Abbott is sitting here with me. She is a physician, and she's also a bioethicist, and that's a word that needs description. And Jennifer Ballantyne is here by phone. She is also a bioethicist with 20 years in hospice. And the focus of the show today actually is not the two polarized discussions around physician aid in dying. We can cover those in about 2 minutes. But it's the underlying relationship to end of life, relationship to our personal and our social and our moral and ethical responsibilities to look at what it is that we are dealing with. And what I guess I would say is that in this country right now, our cultural imperatives and our cultural mores tend to look at death as frightening, and therefore life is frightening. So we've got an underpinning here that comes from a very specific focus, and that is, this is all frightening and we need to control it, or this is all frightening and we don't want our lives to end. So when you, when you look at this one particular issue, physician aid in dying, you cannot separate it out from all the other issues around death and dying. How we care for people who have dementia, hospice care, all of those things are driven by the same fears, and they end up manifesting the same fear-based decisions. So I wanted to start out basically saying, as we talk about physician aid in dying, we really have to look at the larger picture first. There are the personal pieces, how we all feel about whether or not we have control. That's the word that comes up, over how we live as well as how we die. When we look at maybe legislation coming up, there are really serious issues underlying the decision. Not just do we get to make the decision, but, you know, in Oregon and other places where this legislation has gone through, there's been extensive education of physicians. There's been extensive education of systems before the legislation goes through. So some of this logistically is really dicey. But the larger picture, I think, is the one where we have to start. And that is really, what is the value of our lives? How do we hold that? And in that sense, I think the most compelling is the emotional response. But the most responsible is to look at how any of these issues affect all of us all the way through end-of-life care.
As we always say, Kim, when we do these shows, we're all going to die. It's guaranteed. And yet there's such reticence in society by talking about it. We do not talk about end of life issues in a way that we can get away from those knee jerk emotional reactions. And do you think that's because we're just terrified of the prospect of it? Is it cultural? Because I know other societies, other cultures do embrace end of life and have those discussions in a much more, I don't want to say the term healthy, but seems a healthy way, less inhibited way.
Or more mature in a lot of ways. Yeah, I mean, we could look at many different starting points, and Jean and Jennifer might have different ideas, but I do think our unknown, the idea that death is so unfamiliar to us makes it frightening in ways that it isn't, as soon as you start to get more relationship to it.
Well, we'll introduce our guests now. Jean Abbott joining us in the studio. As Kim Mooney said, you're a physician and a bioethicist. And we will explain exactly what that means, because it's not a term we hear every day. We're also joined on the phone by Jennifer Ballantyne, who is with the IRIS Project. She's also a bioethicist, and she's got 20 years experience in hospice care. Jean, can you explain exactly what does it mean to be a bioethicist?
I thought you were going to help me by telling me a little bit about it. This is a specialty within medicine that has been developing over the last 20, 30 years, asking some big values-based questions and helping physicians and healthcare people ask the why questions, understanding people's values, the values that underlie the choices that they make, how those can become intention, between when we struggle with the values of I want to be able to make my own choices versus physicians wanting to do good for patients or not to harm them, justice issues of how do we use the resources in our society? How do we be fair to everybody? Those are the big picture questions that I have fun asking at bedside rounds and grappling with physicians who are trying to do the best for patients.
And is this just something that is an academic exercise, or does it really underpin policy at a hospital level, at a governmental level? When we're talking about that, how do we allocate resources? Who gets to have choice around these issues?
It would be very nice if bioethicists were around the table. They are often. And in fact, the Hospital Association requires that each hospital have an ethics committee, and other organizations such as hospice and long-term care facilities have ethics committees or access to ethics. And that's actually a requirement. How it's used, how our voice is heard around the table as we grapple with these difficult issues varies a lot.
Most ethics committees are actually also comprised of physicians, maybe lawyers, civilians, people from many, many different walks of life, usually people in the institution and people in the community, so that they bring in a lot of voices and a lot of different aspects.
And don't forget nurses, chaplains, social workers. Our ethics committee is one of the most robust and multidisciplinary groups in our hospital.
And are
you? Jump in?
Oh, please do, Jennifer Ballantyne.
Hi, thanks.
You are also a bioethicist, and you've at least 20 years' experience working in hospice care. I'd like your contribution. What's your take on this?
Well, I think one of the things that I appreciate so much about ethics is that, you know, it is kind of a head discipline rather than a heart discipline, although the heart certainly is involved in it. But it allows us to step back a bit from the, emotional, personal, immediate, urgent issues that are unfolding at the bedside, and apply a little bit of distance, a little bit of framework, a little bit of perspective around those issues, so that we're not just solely caught up in the story that's unfolding. And the story that's unfolding, of course, is critically important. And at the end of the day, the issues come back to those individuals, and we're trying the very best we can to to help them sort through what they are going through. But it does allow us to kind of take a couple of steps back and be a little bit more objective about things, and to apply a wider lens to the issues.
Well, as we are in the early stages of this show, and we're kind of clarifying different terminology, I think it's probably a good time to just talk about language and how polarizing that has been in this particular end of life discussion, and really to clarify what we're talking about here, because we are talking about physician aid in dying. I did a piece last week with the representative of Compassion and Choices, which is a national body around end of life choices, and they were very clear about the use of language. Mm-hmm. The difference between assisted suicide, the difference between aid in dying and physician aid in dying. Kim, Jennifer, or Jean, absolutely. Does anybody want to jump in on that aspect of language to clarify what we're talking about and what we're not talking about?
Absolutely. And one thing I will say about all three of us is that I think all three of us could sit in every single seat on this issue and argue it very successfully. So that's what I would hope that people would leave here, not with answers, but with a lot more questions. And the piece of language really goes back to that very personal sense again, is it defines us. Not only do we come from places where language makes a difference, but the word suicide, as we've talked about many times on the show, has a lot of moral and religious implications. It implies failure, it implies sin, whatever. Physician aid in dying, of course, defines a relationship, a very different relationship. One thing I will say simply is that we don't like the word euthanasia over here. We apply it to our pets. We do not perform a euthanasia over here. But in Europe, that is what their physician aid in dying, whatever we want to call it over there, that's what they would describe it as, and they find it somewhat abhorrent that we would require a patient to do this on their own over here. So the language starts to define what we use or how we use it, but the concept still has to be understood underneath it. And we see this with a lot of medical language, that a word will come up, we'll have a reaction to it, and we need people to explain what it means to us in that context.
Well, Jean Abbott, as a physician and a bioethicist, does that issue of language, does that really create roadblocks for so many of these discussions?
It certainly does. As Kim has so nicely articulated, the term suicide is a very electric term and not appropriate to this discussion. There are other terms. I round in the intensive care unit and help physicians grapple with issues there. And when we try to talk to them about do not resuscitate, that's a very electric term. It implies I don't love my loved one enough. We talk about do everything. We talk about life support. We talk about a lot of terms that have pictures in people's mind about what that means and what life means, even something so simple and profound as that.
Jennifer Ballantyne, would you like to weigh in on that issue of language, how it's been used in many ways to polarize this discussion and how it can create roadblocks when we are talking about end-of-life choices?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think language is essential. It's very important. And I think that, you know, on the one hand, language can be used as a weapon, and it can be used very intentionally to polarize. I think that does happen in this debate some amount of time. But I think it can also be used to obscure and to minimize, you know, the importance and the significance of the issues that we're talking about. I mean, I do sometimes insist on using suicide to describe this phenomenon in its strictest interpretation of self-killing. And just to say, you know, if I am taking a life-ending medication, I am ending my life. You know, it's just a clinical definition of what is actually happening in the circumstance. You know, I give over and don't use that term, you know, when among friends in trying to find common ground, you know, in this discussion. But I think we minimize and soften language somewhat to our peril in this conversation. And, you know, I think it's important to be clear about what, in fact, we are talking about. The one thing I always insist on in talking about this is to include the word physician, because in all of the laws that are being passed, that are being proposed, the physician holds a very, very central role and is really in control of the process, you know, except for the request at the beginning and the ingestion of the medication at the end. The physician is the one who really administers the entire process. So anytime we leave out physician from the term, that actually really distorts, I think, the option as it is being proposed in law.
That's Jennifer Ballantyne, who's a bioethicist. She's got 20 years experience in hospice care. She's one of my guests this morning here at KGNU, along with Jean Abbott, who is a physician, also a bioethicist. My co-host this morning is Kim Mooney of Practically Dying. This is another in our quarterly series looking at end-of-life issues. Today we're talking about the complexity of physician aid in dying. Jean Abbott, do you want to weigh in on anything that Jennifer just said there?
Well, I think the words that we use oftentimes reflect the values of our culture. And we have a very unique culture. We have to realize that the things that are held important in the United States are not necessarily held with the same weight in other societies. We're a society of science. We think that medicine can cure everything. We have sort of a technologic imperative, if you would, that says that if there is something that can be brought to bear on an illness, it should be brought to bear. And because of that, we've let the term dying become synonymous with failure. Physicians hate to have somebody who dies. It feels like they've screwed up or that they've not been able to do their duty. We are exceptional in this country. We all think that everybody else is going to die. You said the death rate's 100%. I agree with that. But we have this exceptionalism where we think that excludes me. And so as a society and as physicians, we don't accept the fact that that is part of the arc of life and that there's a mystery at the end and that this is a natural phenomenon. We talk about physician aid in dying, but we could call the intensive care unit perhaps death interrupted unit, but we don't.
Well, we're going to be inviting listeners to weigh in just a few minutes, but I'd like to delve a little bit further into this topic, physician aid in dying. It is very likely going to be headed to the state legislature mm-hmm. again in the upcoming session. A measure was defeated in the last session, a lot of that centering on language, mm-hmm. as we've heard. But Kim Mooney, what have been some of the most polarised arguments for and against physician aid in dying? And as you said earlier, everybody on this panel could take all sides in this argument at various different points. It is that complex. So talk mm-hmm. about some of the main arguments that really have been the most polarizing and maybe the ones that have led to misinformation for people.
Well, on the one side of the teeter-totter, we have the, and I will say led by the boomers, the idea that we are autonomous, that we are individuals and we should have absolute control over when and how we die. And I think that's the most compelling because it's the easiest for people to get a personal relationship to. Me, me, me. This is what I want. I want that. I want that. Personally, I'm saying me, Kim, want that. On the other side, quote unquote, what we have is people who are saying religiously that it's God's right to choose when and how we die. People who, the medical profession, oftentimes saying we know more about, you know, they have really been the profession that's been, quote, in charge of this. But I use quotes in the same way we're talking about physician. So these, I'll explain a little bit more in a second. We have marginalized groups that are afraid that, again, once we start to culturally, what they call a slippery slope, provide a slippery slope, that they too will be influenced, even though they may not be influenced directly with this bill. So you see people hiding their emotional, well, that's a very rude thing to say. So I think that it tends to be more polarized around people who think that you should not be able to do this for religious, medical, spiritual reasons, and people who just say, me, I want my way. Now, the I want your way, I think, falls into two things. I think people are just afraid of dying in general, and then I think people are afraid of losing control.
Jennifer?
Yeah, if I can comment on that. I mean, I think that you're absolutely right that represents the sort of extremes of the polarization. But for me, I come at this from a perspective of hospice and palliative care. And in hospice, there is a fundamental value that death should neither be hastened nor prolonged. And, you know, where I land in this is that I tend to think that physician aid in dying represents either the complete failure of medicine or the triumph of the way of Burger King. I'll explain that a little bit, that it represents either an unacceptable capitulation to our complete inability to treat and care for people who are suffering, or to the triumph of that first world sort of ultimately privileged insistence on having it my way. I would like instead, you know, not ascribing to a religious perspective on this particularly and not wanting to give in to that me, 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 autonomous, I want it my way. I would like us instead to be focusing our efforts on making the process of dying neither over-medicalized and a matter of torture and suffering, but also not a matter of expedient demise. You know, so it's really kind of emphasizing instead that there is a middle way of palliative medicine that seeks to every dimension, but also recognizing that the end of life can be an opportunity for great growth, for resolution, for renewal, for becoming more friendly with death rather than denying it. And I tend to think that just popping a pill at the end of the day is just another manifestation of our pathological relationship with death rather than a true acceptance either on a personal level or on a social level that we will in fact all die.
That's Jennifer Ballantyne, who's a medical ethicist, joining us here at KGNU. Well, Kim Mooney and Jean Abbott, bioethicist Jean Abbott and a physician, Kim Mooney with Practically Dying. Would you like to respond to any of what Jennifer has said there?
Yeah, actually, I think that one of the things that's the most difficult is that we do hear, and I hear from all of us, pretty absolute statements. And, I agree with Jennifer. I think that there's great possibility for growth at end of life, personally, for most people. And I think hospice is a better alternative for most people. But I think one of the reasons this argument gets so inflamed is that that's not true for everybody. So when there is a generalized solution, the people for whom hospice has not been successful after 22 years in hospice. And I guess the word successful would even be something I would break apart. So I think that there are, we have to be very careful about how we fall down absolutely on any one of these, because it's easy to find any one of us has a situation we can describe.
Jean Abbott, would you like to weigh in on this?
Well, let me put my physician hat on here for a second and talk about how we move from absolutes to nuances.
Great.
I teach medical students, and if you would ask a class of first-year medical students what their role as a doctor is, they would probably say to save lives. That's a very simple idea that most people have when they go into medicine. As they go along, the old motto that we hear often becomes more clear to them, which is that we cure sometimes, that we treat often, and that we comfort always. And frankly, we don't cure that often these days. We have become a society of chronic diseases. We've cured all the easy ones, and so people are living far longer with a whole cluster of chronic diseases, and our job as physicians has morphed. It's become more of accompanying people on the journey. And when I hear that, one of my colleagues has said it probably best in an editorial in JAMA recently. The essence of being a caring clinician is working with patients to help them achieve the life they want to lead. That's it. We're consultants in the service of people. We're the experts in medical science, and patients are the experts in what's important to them. Now, that's a real mind twister for a lot of physicians, but it also leads to the question that I think Jennifer is challenging us with, which is how much do we acquiesce as a physician community to patients wanting control, total control, and how much do we guide them to accepting the growth and the mystery that accompanies the end of all of our lives?
Or that could. Could. That's where I want to just keep taking the absolutes out. It may or it may not. And that's where, for me, that whole sense of what we call autonomy, which is never really autonomy, comes in, is how is anybody going to decide what my desires are at the last part?
But our job, one of our jobs, is to push as physicians against the initial choice of a patient to help them imagine things that might be possible that they wouldn't think about. Yeah. That happens with the third round of chemotherapy. That happens with, would you mind being paraplegic or quadriplegic? Helping people imagine things that they at first blush say, oh my gosh, I don't want to go through that, is part of the role of physicians. On the other hand, there's a certain point, as you point out, with a certain number of people, and I think it's very small, where they say, no, I'm not imagining something that is better than death. I know that death is coming, and I would like to have some control over the method and the time of that.
And I want to push back on one thing. Again, absolutism, I agree with you when you are talking about aware, informed, compassionate physicians willing to spend the time who have the skills to do that. There are physicians who aren't. And so this
Many.
Whole thing gets very, very, well, there's a spectrum, but there, what I'm saying is this whole thing gets really muddy according to what's on paper, what we would like, and then real life.
That is.
Well, that's actually something that struck me as Jean was talking. You know, I think that we live in very rarefied air. And when I say we, I mean the three of us in this conversation, but also the community that we're speaking to. You know, that the people who are very engaged in this issue tend to be people who have gotten a lot of information for themselves. They've thought deeply about this. They perhaps have seen their family members or friends go through things that they either would like for themselves or don't want to get anywhere near. They are a very educated and informed population. When I sort of step back, though, and I think about how this plays out across a state, you know, of a population that we know, for the most part, never thinks about death until they absolutely have to, you know, and a large swath of the physician population that, as Jean points out, is very, very uncomfortable with the concept that anyone might die on their watch, is not good at talking about these issues, is not good about being that kind of patient-centered consultant. You know, that when it plays out on that sort of larger, messier stage, it strikes me that it just is not the way that I would like our healthcare system to be going. I think we have much more work to do. The fact that we fail with a few people in hospice or in palliative care that would prefer this option after a lot of thought does not, to me, justify making it available to anyone and everyone, you know, with who meets the criteria. You know, I think that we have a lot more work to do to make sure that hospice and palliative care are absolutely the very best that they can be and accessible across the state, you know, and well-funded and well-supported before we would go anywhere near this option.
That's Jennifer Ballantyne. She's a bioethicist. She's got 20 years' experience in hospice care. She's one of my guests this morning here at KGNU Boulder, Denver. It's 2 minutes past 9 o'clock, and we're here till the bottom of the hour talking about physician aid in dying. My other guest is Jean Abbott, who's a physician, also a bioethicist. And my co-host this morning is Kim Mooney of Practically Dying. Kim joins me on a quarterly basis on KGNU to talk about end-of-life issues. This morning, we are looking at the complexity of physician aid in dying, given that it is very likely to be brought up again at the next legislative session here in Colorado. It was recently defeated in the last session. And to that end, I will open up the phone lines if anybody would like to weigh in. 303-442-4242 if you have a question or a comment. But also I'd like to just jump off on something that Jennifer, I think, was alluding to. When you're looking at something that is so complex with so much nuance, is it possible to create blanket legislation for this type of thing? How much can we actually legislate around something that is so nuanced and so complex? Kim Mooney.
You know, I think it's a matter of timing it, not timing it so much as thinking about it in stages. I think any legislation, you know, usually goes through and then gets corrected. So the argument here sits either don't do it because we can't control it, or do it and then let's figure out how to educate to it. I personally favor do it and let's educate to it, as opposed to not doing it at all. But anyway.
Jean Abbott, your thoughts on that? I mean, can you legislate around this type of complex issue?
Well, there has to be some protection for physicians to be allowed to participate in this, as if we as a society believe that this should be an option, a quiver in our toolbox. And I think that the legislation is blunt. We're a legal society, and we put way too much stock in legal solutions. And my biggest fear with this legislation is that the legislators will be able to wipe their hands and say, so we've solved the problem of end of life. Let's move on to flood control.
Exactly.
Whatever.
Exactly.
Yes. On the other hand, I don't think with Jennifer that just because we do not have a perfect hospice palliative care system in this country, and she's absolutely right that the vast majority of our work needs to be to give fair, equal access to quality palliative and end-of-life care to everybody in this country, not just the ones with insurance, not just the people who have college educations, but to everybody. And that's an unjust situation that is really problematic. But I do believe that for those of us who believe that we don't want to wipe our hands at death's door for some of our patients and say, okay, you're on your own right now because I can't go there. I think there are a fair number of physicians who would like to have the option of staying with our patients through that last stage.
We have several callers who are holding right now, waiting to join the conversation. We'll go next to Mike in Denver. Welcome to KGNU. You're live on the air.
Hey, thank you. And a great conversation it is. I You know, there's just so much to say, but I'll be brief. You can't think about these issues too much. Hopefully, somewhere after adolescence. But frequently, like one of the ladies there said, that people put this off. It's a death denying culture. And I remember many years ago when I first encountered a book that they're acquainted with, no doubt. Many people are Ernest Becker's The Denial of Death, mm-hmm. Which is a great classic. And then about a decade ago, a professor of psychiatry at Stanford University, professor emeritus now, I guess, Irvin Yalom, called Staring at the Sun. Mm-hmm. And, he's a psychiatrist. He went to George Washington Medical School, and he's written a lot of textbooks. But basically, he said this part of his practice in that book, and I'm sure both of you have read that he references philosophy, the fundamental issues, Socrates, all of it. And the thing is the palliative care. My father suffered like a dog before he died, and he died about 7 years ago, actually, on December the 13th. He passed away at age 86 and a half. And he had grown up in rough circumstances, seen a lot of stuff. But when it comes to your own personal death, he was a good man, a brave guy. But he needed bereavement counseling for his own coming death. Mm-hmm. And he was in home hospice for about a year and a half or two. And my sister was a bereavement counselor for other people, so she was in the same room when he died. But these are issues that cannot be addressed too much, and for anybody that's thinking. And so I just want to thank you, all of you, for the conversation. And, life is wonderful, but it's like my grandmother used to say, my mother's mother, who died when I was 23, she said, life's great. Unless you weaken, mm-hmm. The pain and that last comment about one of the doctors there about the palliative care, that to me seems an absolute no-brainer.
Yes.
And there was a film that I saw many years ago with the Denver Film Society from Canada called Barbarians at the Gates or something, about a professor, college professor, who was dying. And his son got him heroin on the black market in Toronto to ease his pain. He was dying of cancer, and he showed the little IV thing in his arm, and he died of a voluntary overdose of heroin. And he was hooked on it for a while, of course, but he was terminal. And I remember one of the lines in the scene is his son, broke the law to help his father not have that pain. And they said, well, how you feeling, Dad? He said, are you in any pain? He said, oh, yeah, but I don't care. And he was, he went out of his own volition. And I've talked enough. But
thanks very much, Mike, for calling in and sharing that.
It's a great conversation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, I want to say one thing to that, and I would also agree with what Jennifer and Jean said. I think 100% we should be focusing our efforts on providing good, compassionate, smart end-of-life care. I really believe that, but we're not doing it right now. And what I'm saying, I would rather see this legislation pass. Having someone have to take morphine, heroin in a back alley is really different than having sketchy legislation where we're at least trying to hold this in a context and it's legal. That's a horrendous thing that he just described. So,
it's a horrendous thing, but it's also a Hollywood scene. I don't see that we're I don't doubt that there are circumstances of people truly suiciding, out of desperation. but I honestly think that the problem is not that widespread. I don't see the need for this legislation in Colorado to solve that particular problem.
Before we move on to our next caller, Jean Abbott, did you want to weigh in on that?
Just a quick point that our caller highlighted, which is that natural dying doesn't occur these days. Our grandparents died oftentimes fairly abruptly over a period of days or weeks. We don't do that these days. We have wonderful medical technology to extend life, but we also extend dying, and there are a large number of people in that gray zone of multiple medical conditions, and some of them rise heroically to it. Some of them have great learning and growth during that time, but for some of those people, there is a lot of suffering that extending their dying rather than their living has caused. And I think the caller highlighted that.
That's Jean Abbott, physician and bioethicist, one of our guests, along with Jennifer Ballantyne, a bioethicist with many, many years of experience in hospice care. Kim Mooney of Practically Dying joining us this morning here at KGNU as we talk about the complexity of physician aid in dying. We do have a lot of calls, and we'll go next to Carrie in Colorado Springs. Welcome to the show. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you so much. First, gosh, my heart just goes out to people like Mike's dad, who didn't have good care around death. Mm-hmm. And there just has to be things we can do about that. Mm-hmm. But I have a friend who is disabled, and she and I've talked about this, and she is really adamantly opposed to it because in her experience, she's seen firsthand how health care can minimize the value of the lives of disabled people. So I guess my question is, what about people who are on the fringes of society? They're vulnerable. Maybe there's a greedy family member who wants to push them into suicide and even take control of the drugs, the lethal drugs or something. How is it even possible to control it? This seems dangerous to me. Thank you for taking my call.
I'll answer that. And that's why I think we're all going to keep going back to, in the best of all possible worlds, we would have informed, compassionate companionship during any of these processes where the questions individually for each family would come up. What you're talking about could seriously be an issue with this legislation. It's seriously an issue without the legislation. So again, creating a context in which we can address all these things seems to me much more important than leaving it out there and having it being helter-skelter.
This goes back to the question I had a little bit earlier. How can you legislate around this for every eventuality, given that there are so many unspoken pressures on people internally, maybe people feeling that they're being a burden, even if the family is not saying it. Maybe they're worried about running out of resources, and maybe they can hide that from the physician that they're hoping to help them with that. I mean, how do you then, Jean Abbott, you're a physician, you talked about the ideal solution is having a physician every step of the way along with the patient. I mean, how do you take into account all of those dynamics?
That's a very Pollyanna-ish wish. You're absolutely right. And I'll have to invoke Kim's word, messy. We do see people, as Kim says, already at the bedside who are families with multiple mixed motives. How many of us don't have mixed motives when we're sitting with a dying person who's suffering, but whose inheritance we will get, who we're having to stop our job because we're caring for them? There are all sorts of ambivalent, ambiguous motives that people have even now. This legislation actually is so clean that it excludes an awful lot of that. We've found that marginalized people, that is one of the biggest concerns and worries with any end-of-life legislation, that physician aid in dying, that the vulnerable will be nudged into accepting physician aid in dying, either because they don't have access to good palliative care or because they feel like they're a burden. And being a burden is one of the top reasons that people access this. Interestingly enough, in Oregon, predominantly the people who access physician aid in dying are more educated than the average, Caucasian, more a higher socioeconomic status. They're the ones that know about this and ask about it. But it is constantly a worry and constantly something that the society needs to be vigilant about.
And I want to hit
I do want to, if I can jump in on that. I mean, I think that the data from Oregon is reassuring overall, you know, about how this is so some of the worst fears about the potential for abuse of those marginalized populations have not come to pass. However, Oregon is, you know, I think that the demographics of the people who are availing themselves of this option in Oregon say more about the demographics of Oregon than about the option, you know, and how this is going to play out, for instance, in California, where the law was just passed this last legislative session with 10 times the population and much, much, much more diversity across the socioeconomic spectrum, will be very interesting to see. I tend to think that, that the potential for abuse is much more subtle, but it is absolutely there. I think the minute that we sort of decide as a society that this class of person is eligible for expedited death, that sends a message to all other people who might be in that class or in some way overlapping with that class that they might be, you know, that they perhaps should take advantage of that option. I actually had a conversation this summer with a young person, very, very near and dear to my heart, who was struggling with some psychological and physical issues. And he was on the verge of pathological suicide and said to me, well, you know, if terminally ill people can stop their suffering, if it's okay for them to do that, why shouldn't I be able to do that? You know, so I think that there is a societal message that gets sent, sort of going back to the title of our show, you know, How We Die Matters. There's a societal message that is sent around how we care for, how we value, and how we support people in a number of vulnerable positions. Mm-hmm.
Well, we have some callers standing by. Kim, did you want to weigh in on that before we go to our next caller?
No.
Up next, yeah. We'll go to Neil in Boulder. You are live on the air here at KGNU.
I came in a little late, so I hope this is on not too far off point. About Alzheimer's, I have a couple of friends who, because of their family's histories and their own lapses in memory, are concerned about Alzheimer's, and their attitude is, well, they'll kill themselves, that's the logical way out if that comes to that point. And I'm just, and I think of myself as well, and how that seems like such a doomsday situation. And I'm wondering if the panel has any suggestions of, well, how to work with others with those feelings. Is there any positives in that process, and just any thoughts on that type of situation?
Neil, great question, Neil. Thank you so much. Jean Abbott, your physician, a bioethicist, you kind of alluded to this earlier, that the role of a doctor in an ideal world is to be with that patient and to help them understand all stages and all options. I mean, that seems to tie in with what Jerry was asking. Neil was asking.
Neil, the question of dementia is, I think, one of the most electric ones in our society. And I'm not meaning the word. I'm meaning the whole specter of dementia. It's also a justice issue in terms of the physician aid in dying legislation, because people have to be able to have to be competent, they have to have decision-making capacity, and they have to be able to ingest the drugs themselves. There are people in Europe who look at us and say, you are being very unjust with the narrow law that you have right now, because there are people who are going to induce their own death early because they have Alzheimer's and they have to do it while they can do it themselves, because physicians will not journey that next step that we aren't even talking about in this country, which is physician active aid in dying. It's one of the very, again, messy issues in this whole idea, because dementia, you're not going to be able in the end stages oftentimes to participate. And the question then becomes, how much joy are you getting, and is the life of dementia a difficult one?
And the question is also, at what point, who makes that decision?
Indeed.
And it goes back to autonomy. And I mean, I have personal experience with this with my father, who had 10 years of just an awful progressive dementia until, you know, he died. And he always said, as did Neil, if I ever get to that point, please do something. But who could make that decision? I'm not even talking about legally, but morally. And he was a different person when he had dementia.
Indeed. And so there's a big philosophical debate about what is your authentic self, and does your authentic self change when you have dementia? On the Alzheimer's Association website, there's actually an advanced directive page that people can describe the points at which, as their dementia of any sort progresses, what they think would be a life not worth living for them.
Yeah, I think the whole question of dementia is very, very, very difficult and beyond the scope, obviously, of this conversation. But Gene's right. You know, this law would not help anyone with dementia because, you know, first of all, you know, you have to be competent to take the medication, but you also have to be terminal to qualify. And usually in a dementia diagnosis, if you're competent, you're not yet terminal. You know, so it this sort of speaks to the, you know, what I keep coming back to about this whole law and the whole thing is that what an inadequate solution it is to the problem of suffering at the end of life. You know, it at the very, very best, it might benefit, quote unquote, 100 people a year in Colorado, you know, whereas tens of thousands of people are grappling with these issues of chronic progressive illness that is not yet terminal, of very, very difficult decisions, caregiver burden, and you know, that's where we need to be focusing our resources and energy, is on improving supports and care for that population, not expediting the death of people who are terminal and will die very shortly in any case.
I guess what I would say is, again, not to fall on one side or the other, is that I agree with that, but hospice has not been able to do that in 30 or 40 years. We have not yet, as a culture, been able to adopt that both frame of mind and that social structure. We just haven't been able to. So for us on either side of this to hold out and say, wait a minute, we should only do it this way, or wait a minute, we have to, you know, allow everyone without any questioning, without any kind of intervention, to pop the pill, as you say, I don't think either one of those are responsible.
How has it not been able to do that, Ken? Well, I mean, we do 50% of deaths in Colorado are preceded by hospice services. You know, it, you know, maybe not for long enough, you know, but hospice is in the culture. You know, it is an available option for people who are suffering, and for the vast majority of people who access the services, their suffering is handled and relieved.
I would say, you know, with all of the conversations we've had around this, this would not be an issue if hospice were able to take care of, and people understood it and used it, and it were able to take care of all these issues. This would not be an issue at all.
Well, we have one caller who's holding. We're going to go next to Jerry in Greeley. Welcome to our conversation here at KGNU on How We Die Matters, the complexity of physician aid in dying. Good morning, Jerry.
Good morning to you, and thank you for the conversation. A couple of things I wanted to bring up. One, any discussion of this has to be accompanied by a discussion of single-payer health care, because otherwise you have financial pressures that become a factor. I definitely don't have a problem with this being an option. The problem I foresee is this may become the only option, particularly in some of the mean times we live in. I do disagree with the third party being able to do it. I think this is an important conversation to have, but I think we should also weigh in with our friends in the disabled community, because many of them are legitimately very concerned. I actually have to go pretty soon, so I'll just kind of let you guys go and listen. Thanks for your time. Have a good day.
Thank you very much, Jerry. And this goes back to what we talked about earlier, some of those unspoken pressures that can often be put on an end-of-life situation, one of them being resources. And Jean Abbott.
Yes, I think Jerry hits the nail on the head that I won't talk single payer, but certainly universal health care, even if I might be a single payer person, universal health care is mandatory if people are going to have fair access to all of the palliative and hospice services that they deserve to help them have a quality end of life, as Jennifer is pleading for.
Jennifer, I think that's
absolutely. And in fact, you know, we've already seen some evidence of this out of Oregon, where several patients who are participating in their version of Medicaid have wanted to get treatment for sort of maintenance treatment for terminal conditions, and have been turned down, but have been offered coverage for life-ending medication. So I think, you know, this is one of those sort of expedience pieces that worries me a great deal, you know, that, you know, this prescription costs somewhere in the neighborhood, you know, depending on how many pills you take, it's anywhere from, you know, $1,500, and that's a lot cheaper to any payer than any kind of end-of-life care, which is averaging about $11,000 per patient per entire course of care. You know, hospice is by far the most economical option available now for terminal care, but it's much more expensive than a life-ending medication. Now, we're a long, long, long way from that coming about, but nevertheless, I think the risk is there.
Well, we just have 5 minutes left, and I would like everyone to have a chance for final comments here on this topic of How We Die Matters, the complexity of physician aid in dying. Kim Mooney, did you want to weigh in?
Well, I guess what I would say finally is the way we started this discussion really is that none of these issues stand on their own. So we have disability communities worried about this when it may not even affect them. It speaks to the fact that all of these end-of-life issues have charge and, you know, importance for all of us. So I think that's really important to remember. When you're thinking about this, you're thinking about all of them. And my response to the slippery slope arguments, which I hear on both sides, is that everything we've ever done is a slippery slope. This is not any more slippery than beginning life-sustaining medical treatments. Look what that got us, you know, when it looked like a good thing at the beginning. That's why my position on all of this is, let's bring it into the light so we do have a better chance of controlling it or managing it or having important conversations rather than just hope that it goes away.
That's Kim Mooney of Practically Dying, my co-host this morning here at KGNU as we talk about end-of-life issues, as we do on a quarterly basis this morning, talking about the complexity of physician aid in dying. My other guest has been Jean Abbott, who is a physician and a bioethicist. Jean, do you have any closing thoughts here?
Sure, just a couple to follow up on Kim. One is that the silver lining of this legislation is just a conversation like this. It is complex, but we are starting to talk about the D word that everybody is afraid to talk about, which is death and dying. And since it's the holiday season, I'll encourage everybody who wants to think more complexly about this to also go out. One of our call-in people recommended a couple books. I'll recommend Being Mortal by Atul Gawande. It's a great stocking stuffer. Might be a little hard to get in your stocking, but is a wonderful book for starting to think about some of the narratives and the stories that are so compelling that provoke us to think more deeply about this issue.
But there will be a number of presentations next year that I'm going to be doing. So when we talk about my website, I want people to be able to follow that up with some community dialogues. But before Jennifer closes out, I want to thank her because she has been willing in public to take the most unpopular position on this in a long time. And it's really important that we hear it.
Well, and I do believe that it has really driven the conversation into areas that we don't often get to. So all that being said, Jennifer Ballantyne, your many, many years experience in hospice care, you are a bioethicist. In the last couple of minutes that we have, what are your final thoughts on this issue?
Well, I want to thank Kim for having me and for Jean and for all of the thoughtful reflection that goes into this. I think we rarely get an opportunity to kind of get past the polarizing sound bites on this issue. And even in this 1 hour, we've barely scratched the surface. You know, and I would just urge all the listeners, you know, as this debate unfolds over the next few months, to try to think beyond the sound bites, you know, to think beyond their own personal stories even, and to think about how this might impact systems and societies and how, you know, what does it really mean about a culture where we are so afraid of being cared for that we would prefer to die quickly, that we are so afraid of dying that we would prefer to end our own lives. That says a lot about the state of our healthcare system. It says a lot about the state of our culture. It says perhaps something about the state of our families. And all of these things need attention. And I think one of the more unfortunate aspects of the polarization around this issue is that it tends to divide the very community that should be so united around all of the issues, you know, to improve care, to relieve suffering, and to really bring about a better relationship with death, which, you know, we all will get there. Absolutely.
And that would be the human community.
Yeah. Exactly.
Well, I'd like to thank all of our guests this morning. Jennifer Ballantyne, she's many, many years experience working in hospice care. She's a bioethicist. Jean Abbott joined us in the studio. She's a physician, also a bioethicist. My co-host this morning, Kim Mooney of Practically Dying. And the website, Practically Dying, Practically-Dying.
Yeah, practically-dying.com. I'll have events on there, ways you can stay connected. And I'd love to hear comments.
And tomorrow morning on The Morning Magazine, we're going to talk more about end-of-life issues. And we're going to hear about a symposium or workshop. Really, it is a symposium on remembering those who have passed. It's happening tomorrow evening at the Columbine Unity Spiritual Center. So we're going to speak with somebody from Conversations on Death about that. Mm-hmm. That's on tomorrow's Morning Magazine. As I have said, these conversations with Kim Mooney of Practically Dying, we have quarterly conversations on end-of-life issues. You can find the archives of them at our website, news.kgnu.org. I'd like to thank Kathy for handling the phones, all of our callers who really brought some excellent points this morning, and all of our guests. And you, our listeners, thank you so much for tuning in. I've been your host, Maeve Conran. Stay tuned. Brian is in for the Morning Sound Alternative. You're listening to KGNU.